22. By Monday morning, the projection was complete. TM workers, armed, carried it upstairs to the transmitter and stood guard over it. The telemedia building was sealed off. Nobody came and nobody went. During the day, the hints, spots, mentions on various media dinned like pond frogs. Tension began to build, a sense of expectancy. The public was alive to the topic of active assimilation, although nobody knew what it meant.
"Opinion," Sugarman said, "runs about 2-1 in favor of restoring a cautious policy of active assimilation."
A poll had been taken, and the results were arriving.
"Active assimilation's too good for those rascals," Gates announced. "Let's have no coddling of traitors."
At 7:45 that evening, Allen assembled his staff in his office. The mood was one of optimism. "Well," Allen said, "it won't be long. Another 15 minutes and we're on the air. Anybody feel like backing out?" Everybody grinned inanely.
"Got your dismissal notice yet?" Gates asked him.
The notice from the committee had arrived registered mail. Now Allen opened the envelope and read the brief, formal statement. He had until noon Thursday. Then he was no longer director of telemedia. "Give me the story on the follow-ups," he said to Gleeby.
"Pardon? Yes.
From a prepared list, Gleeby read him the total projected coverage.
"Up to now it's been groundbreakers. Tonight at 8 comes the actual discussion. Tomorrow night a repeat of the discussion program will be aired by public demand."
"Better move that up," Allen said. "Allows too much time for them to act."
"Make it later tonight," Sugarman suggested. "About 10, as they're all popping into bed."
Gleeby scribbled a few words.
"We've already mailed out duplicate films to the colonies. The discussion has been written up and will be printed in full in Tuesday morning's newspapers, plus comments, pro and con. Late news programs tonight will give resumes. We've had the presses run off paper-bound copies to be sold in commissaries at magazine slots. Youth editions for school use have been prepared, but frankly, I don't imagine we can distribute them in time. It'll take another 4 days.
"And the poll,"
Sugarman added. "Fine," Allen said. "For less than a week, that's not bad." A TM employee entered.
"Mr. Purcell, something's come up. Secretary Frost and Mrs. Hoyt are outside in a committee getabout. They want to be admitted."
"Peace party," Pryor said. "I'll talk to them outside," Allen said. "Show me where they are." The employee led him to the ground floor and outside through the barricade erected before the entrance. In the back seat of a small blue getabout sat the two women, bolt upright, their faces pinched. Ralph Hadler was behind the tiller. He pretended not to notice or in any way conceive of Allen. They were not in the same world.
"Hi,"
Allen said. Mrs. Hoyt said,
"This unworthy is. I'm ashamed of you, Mr. Purcell. I really am."
"I'll make a note of that," Allen said. "What else?"
"Would you have the decency to tell us what you're doing?"
Sue Frost demanded in a low, choked voice. She held up a newspaper.
"Active assimilation? What in the name of heaven is this? Have you all completely lost your minds?"
"We have," Allen admitted. "But I don't see that it matters."
"It's a fabrication, isn't it?"
Sue Frost accused.
"You're inventing it all. This is some sort of horrible prank. If I didn't know better, I'd say you had a hand in the japery of Major Strider's statue. I'd say you're involved in this whole outbreak of anarchist and savage lawlessness."
Her choice of words showed the potency of the campaign. It made him feel odd to hear her speaking right out of the plug.
"Now look,"
Mrs. Hoyt said presently in a tone of forced amiability.
"If you'll resign, we'll see that you regain your lease. You'll be able to continue your agency. You'll be exactly where you were. We'll prepare a guarantee, written, that telemedia will buy from you."
She hesitated.
"And
we'll undertake to expose Blake Moffat for their part in the frame-up.
Alan said, Now I know I'm on the right track. And try to watch TV tonight. You'll get the full story on active assimilation. Re-entering the building, he halted to watch the blue getabout steam away. Their offer had genuinely surprised him. It was amazing how much moral righteousness the breath of scandal could blow down. He ascended by the elevator and joined the group waiting in his office.
Almost time, Sugarman said, consulting his watch. 5 more minutes.
At a rough guess, Gleeby said, dominoes representing 70% of the population will be watching. We should achieve an almost perfect saturation on this single airing.
From a suitcase, Gates produced 2/5 of Scotch whiskey.
To celebrate,
he said, opening both.
Somebody get glasses, or we can pass them around.
The phone rang, and Alan answered it.
Hello, Alan, Myron Mavis's creaky voice came. How are things going?
Absolutely perfect, Alan answered. Want to stop by and join us?
Sorry, can't. I'm bogged down in leaving. All my stuff to get packed for the trip to Sirius.
Try to catch the projection tonight, Alan said. It starts in a couple of minutes.
How's Janet?
Seems to be feeling pretty fair. She's glad it's out in the open, he added. She's watching at the apartment.
Say hello to her, Mavis said. And good luck on your lunacy.
Thanks, Alan said. He said goodbye and hung up.
Time,
Sugarman said. Gates turned on the big TV receiver and they gathered around it.
Here we go.
Here we go, Alan agreed. Mrs. Georgina Birmingham placed her favorite chair before her television set and anticipated her favorite program, The Pageant of Time. She was tired from the hectic activities of the day, but a deep spiritual residuum reminded her that work and sacrifice were their own reward. On the screen was an inter-program announcement. A large, decayed tooth was shown, grimacing with pain. Next to it, a sparkling, healthy tooth jeered sanctimoniously. The two teeth engaged in Socratic dialogue, the upshot of which was the rout and defeat of the bad tooth. Mrs. Birmingham gladly endured the inter-program announcements because they were in a good cause. And the program Pageant of Time was well worth any reasonable effort. She always hurried home early on Monday evening. In 10 years, she hadn't missed an edition. A shower of brightly colored fireworks burst across the screen, and from the speaker issued the rumble of guns. A jagged, slashing line of words cut through the blur of war. The Pageant of Time. Her program had begun. Folding her arms, leaning her head back, Mrs. Birmingham now found herself viewing a table at which sat 4 dignified gentlemen. A discussion was in progress and dim words were audible. Over them was superimposed the announcer's voice. Pageant of Time. Ladies and gentlemen, at this table sit 4 men, each a distinguished authority in his field. They had come together to discuss an issue vital to every citizen of the Morax society. In view of the unusual importance of this program, there will be no interruptions, and the discussion, which is already in progress, will proceed without pause until the end of the hour. Our topic for tonight? Visible words grew on the screen. Active assimilation in the world today. Mrs. Birmingham was delighted. She had been hearing about active assimilation for some time, and this was her opportunity to learn once and for all what it was. Her lack of information had made her feel out of touch. Seated at my right is Dr. Joseph Gleeby, the noted educator, lecturer, writer of numerous books on problems of social values. A lean, middle-aged man smoking a pipe and rubbing his ear was shown. To Dr. Gleeby's right is Mr. Harold Pryor, art critic, architect, frequent contributor to the Encyclopedia Britannica. A smaller individual was shown, with an intense, serious face. Seated next to Mr. Pryor is Professor Sugarman, whose historical studies rank with those of Gibbon, Schiller, Toynbee. We are very fortunate to have Professor Sugarman with us. The camera moved forth to show Professor Sugarman's heavy, solemn features. And next to Professor Sugarman sits Mr. Thomas L. Gates, lawyer, civic leader, consultant to the committee for a number of years. Now the moderator appeared, and Mrs. Birmingham found herself facing Alan Purcell. "And I," Mr. Purcell said, "am Alan Purcell, director of Telemedia." He seated himself at the end of the table by the water pitcher. "Shall we begin, gentlemen? With a few words about the etymology of active assimilation. Just how did Major Strider develop the policy that was to prove so effective in his dealings with opposition groups?"
"Well, Mr. Purcell,"
Professor Sugarman began, coughing importantly and fingering his chin.
"The Major had many opportunities to see firsthand the ravages of war on principally agricultural and food-producing areas, such as the livestock regions of the West, the wheat fields of Kansas, the dairy industry of New England. These were all but wiped out, and naturally, as we all know, there was intensive deprivation, if not actual starvation. This contributed to a decline of overall productivity, affecting industrial reconstruction. And during this period, of course, communications broke down. Areas were cut off. Anarchy was common."
"In that connection," Dr. Glebe put in, "many of the problems of decline of moral standards inherent in the Age of Waste were vastly intensified by this collapse of what little government there was."
"Yes, indeed,"
Professor Sugarman agreed.
"So, in following this historic pattern, Major Strider saw the need of finding new sources of food, and the soil, as we know, was excessively impregnated with toxic metals, poisons, ash. Most domestic herds had died off."
He gazed upward.
"I believe by 1975 there were less than 300 head of cattle in North America."
"That sounds right," Mr. Purcell said agreeably.
"So,"
Professor Sugarman continued,
"moral reclaimers, as they operated in the field in the form of teams,"
he gestured,
"more or less autonomous units, were familiar with the technique, encountered a virtually insoluble problem. That of feeding and caring for the numbers of persons coming across from hostile groups operating in the same area. In that connection, I might add that Major Strider seems to have foreseen long in advance the continual decline of animal husbandry that was to occur during the next decade. He took steps to anticipate the decline, and of course historians have made a big point of the aptness of those steps."
Professor Sugarman sighed, contemplated his clasped hands, then went on.
"To fully grasp their situation, we must picture ourselves as living essentially without government, in a world of brute force. What concepts of morality existed were found only within the reclaimers' units. Outside of that, it was dog-eat-dog, animal-against-animal, a kind of jungle struggle for survival, with no holds barred."
The table and five men dissolved. In their place appeared familiar scenes of the first post-war years. Ruins, squalor, barbarians snarling over scraps of meat, dried pelt hanging from slatternly hovels, flies, filth.
"Large numbers of opposition groups," Professor Sugarman continued, "were falling into our hands daily, thus complicating an already catastrophic problem of creating a stable diet in the devastated areas. Morek was on the ascendancy, but nobody was so idealistic as to believe the problem of creating a unified cultural milieu could be solved overnight. And the really sobering factor, evidently recognized early by the Major, was the so-called impossible faction, those groups who could never be won over and who were doing the most harm. Since Reclaimers were principally operating against those Impossibles, it was only natural that in the plan worked out by Major Strider, these Impossibles would be the most natural sources for assimilation. Further...
I must disagree,
Mr. Gates interrupted.
If I may, Professor Sugarman, isn't it true that active assimilation had already occurred prior to the Morek plan? The Major was fundamentally an empiricist. He saw assimilation occurring spontaneously, and he was quick to take advantage of it.
I'm afraid that doesn't do justice to the Major's planning ability, Mr. Pryor spoke up. That is, you're making it sound as if active assimilation just happened. But we know active assimilation was basic, preceding the autofac system, which eventually supplanted it. I think we have two points of view here, Mr. Purcell, the moderator, said. But in any case, we agree that Major Strider did utilize active assimilation early in the post-war years to solve the problem of feeding rural populations and of reducing the numbers of hostile and impossible elements.
Yes, Dr. Gleeby said. By 1997, at least, 10,000 impossibles had been assimilated. And numerous byproducts of economic value were being obtained. Glue, gelatins, hides, hair.
Can we fix a date for the first official assimilation? Mr. Purcell asked.
Yes, Professor Sugarman said. It was May of 1987 that 100 Russian impossibles were captured, killed, and then processed by reclaimers operating in the Ukrainian area. I believe Major Strider himself divided an impossible with his family on the 4th of July.
I suppose boiling was the usual processing method, Mr. Pryor commented.
Boiling and, of course, frying. In this case, Mrs. Strider's recipe was used, calling for broiling.
So the term active assimilation, Mr. Purcell said, can historically be used to encompass any form of killing, cooking, and eating of hostile groups, whether it be by boiling or frying or broiling or baking. In short, any culinary method apropos, with or without the preserving of byproducts such as skin, bones, fingernails, for commercial use.
Exactly,
Dr. Gleeby said, nodding.
Although it should be pointed out that the indiscriminate eating of hostile elements without an official
whamp went the television set, and Mrs. Birmingham sat up with dismay. The image had gone dead. The screen was dark. The discussion of active assimilation had been plunged abruptly off the air.